Ladies and gentlemen, are you coffee lovers? Well, then you probably know that the difference between a good cup of coffee and the best cup of coffee is freshly roasted beans. Yet, most brands you get at a shop or at your local grocery store roast their beans months before they get to you. But now there's Sparkplug Coffee. Sparkplug roasts your beans when you order them and delivers straight to your door anywhere in Canada. Sparkplug has flavors and grinds to suit any taste, including a rotating flavor of the month for adventurous types like myself who like to switch it up. Sparkplug also offers regular delivery so that you can set it and forget it and never run out of coffee again. It's time for your favorite cup of coffee to start coming from your own kitchen. So plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Snakes. Oh my God, why did it have to be snakes? Oh my holy God. You think Indy hates snakes. Anyway, ahoy, Arc Raiders, and gracias for taking in the Top 102 Project, where we continue our countdown of the American Film Institute's 1998 and 2007 lists of the greatest American films. Spoiler alertage, we're about to destroy this movie. I am Ryan Ellis with the dog Sam and Fox. Our new addition is Sam. And also here again with my Tomb Raiding wife, Bev.
That's me.
We're warm in our little den studio. The dogs are panting. Everyone just wants to get through this movie as quickly as possible, just like the shoot of Raiders of the Lost Ark. So, the coming attractions trivia for Raiders of the Lost Ark. Raiders was by far the biggest hit of 1981. How many other Steven Spielberg AFI movies was the biggest hit of its year?
I know Jaws was.
That's one.
I don't think Close Encounters was, because that was the same year as Star Wars.
You're right.
I don't think Schindler's List was either, but E.T. was too, so I'm going to say three.
You've got three, but you're missing one of the movies.
Oh, Saving Private Ryan. But so that was that number one?
Jaws, E.T.
Okay, so yeah, I'll go with those three. I'll still go with those.
That
three.
Is correct. Jaws, yeah! E.T., Saving Private Ryan. Close Encounters was a huge hit, but of course Star Wars was far and away number one. And Spielberg's own other movie in 1993, when Schindler's List came out, was Jurassic Park, not an AFI film.
When I was doing my research, for the life of me, I could not remember what the trivia question was, so I really did have to wing it just now.
Well done, then. All right, well, the Top 100 Project's 102nd movie, Indiana Jones and the Raiders of the Lost Ark of the Covenant, brought to you by Nazis, the Holy Ghost, and Snickers, was 60th on AFI's 1998 Top 100, between Rebel Without a Cause and Vertigo. What a weird threesome. Then took a slight drop to 66th, that's a bit of a surprise, in 2007, between The African Queen and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, another weird threesome. Paramount Pictures released their gargantuan hit on June 12, 1981. All right, this is Raiders. Who doesn't know what this movie's about? But Bev, give us a skinny anyway.
No, there is no skinny. You gotta know what this movie's about. Come on.
All right, in a nutshell, grave robber surrenders deadly antiquity after stealing it from them dang Ferners.
The dang Ferners, who I think the antiquity should belong to.
It's been stolen by many dang Ferners. Well, them dang Ferners in this case would be the Nazis, the Germans.
Okay, but it was originally stolen from the Egyptians.
And as they say in the movie, it's been stolen more than once.
Mm-hmm.
As we have Zeppelins going by, in homage to Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade.
Yeah, if you can hear planes in the distance.
So then, the Rotten Tomatoes numbers, and also the Box Office Mojo numbers, and I'm going to do them for all four Indiana Jones films. For Raiders, 95% of critics liked it, 62 fresh, 3 rotten, and 96% of audiences. Wow, those are stronger scores than we've had in quite a while. Temple of Doom was 84 and 81. Last Crusade, a little bit better, actually, 88%, 94%. This won't shock many people. The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was 78%, which is still actually respectable.
Yeah.
But only 54% of audiences were on board with the Crystal Skull, so barely half, and that is a Rotten Tomato.
I wonder if the critics were afraid to give it a truly bad review that maybe they were feeling because they were worried that the fans would give it so much backlash if they did.
I think the fans are a little harder on the fourth movie than they need to be. I think just like with the Star Wars prequels, people expect them to achieve what those movies did, and they never were going to. It wasn't realistic. I don't think Crystal Skull is a bad movie. I bought it, although it's part of the 4-pack Blu-ray anyway. But I did buy it on DVD before that.
Would you have bought it? You did buy it
before.
Yeah, because
I did like it. I didn't think it was wonderful, but I liked it all right. Our friend Carl will probably spank me next time he sees me.
No, that won't happen because there's an embargo on bringing up the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull in the presence of Carl at all times.
I'm not going to say it's a great film, but then again, these are all B films. All right, the other thing I wanted to talk about was the Box Office Mojo Adjusted for Inflation list, which always tells us how truly big a hit is all time. All four movies were on the top 200. Raiders was 20th. That is pretty good. Temple of Doom was 86th. Last Crusade was 100th. And Kingdom of the Crystal Skull was actually 132nd.
Wow.
A bit of a surprise, isn't it? But then again, that's tickets sold. And there's so many more human beings now, and there's so many more theaters now. That does skew things. It really does.
Look at us making excuses for its success.
But when we talk about Gone with the Wind is the biggest hit of all time. Star Wars is number 2. I think Sound of Music is number 3. The top 10 also includes The Sting, Jaws, Ten Commandments. There were fewer people to see movies back in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s than there are today.
Yeah, there were fewer people to see them, but there were fewer movies to choose from. And if you wanted to see a movie more than once, that was the only way to do it. You know, when Gone with the Wind came out, it's not like it was ever going to get a TV release or home video.
Yeah, that's right. No one knew that then. Mm-hmm. That really started happening with movies probably in the 50s and certainly into the 60s. There goes that Zeppelin again. All right, so this movie is a series of remarkable set pieces. The opening itself could have been the climax in most movies. But I'm a big fan of Raiders of the Lost Ark. I always have been. Enjoyed seeing it all over again. In fact, I watched Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade last night just because I felt like watching it. But what about you?
Okay, let me first start by praising Spielberg for being a supremely competent
filmmaker. This sounds like a negative review coming.
Which is obviously not as easy as it looks because there are so many mediocre films turned out at massive budgets. Just nuts and bolts, craft. Spielberg is a total pro, and his instincts are amazing. But he just doesn't play to my personal sensibilities. I get action fatigue really quickly. If a movie is this relentlessly paced, I just wind up kind of feeling bored. You're going to make fun of me. Can't invest in it anymore, and I start zoning out, and I don't pay attention, and I find it boring. Plus, I never saw this until I was in my 20s, so I don't have that nostalgic love for the sillier aspects that kind of belong in a kid's movie, you know, like, why is there a snake in your plane, sir? Or, you know, some of the silly monkey jokes, which actually I was kind of charmed by those. But it's still a fun movie. I don't get the appeal, but the same way I don't get the appeal of Bon Jovi, but I believe people when they tell me that he's a popular artist with songs that people like. And people whose opinions I trust insist that Raiders is a great movie, and I believe them, but it's just not my jam.
You've said that in many of our podcasts, especially of the big monster hits like Star Wars. It wasn't that long ago we saw the Mad Max reboot. Mad Max Fury Road, we saw with some friends. Raiders doesn't let up. Mad Max really doesn't let up.
Yeah, and I felt the same way. Everybody at the end was so charged up, and I was not. I was just kind of relieved it was over and we could go off and do something more fun than watching relentless fights. And
maybe the new Mad Max has too much. Actually, I would say it does. I just saw Avengers the day before we recorded this podcast. You still haven't seen it. I'm talking Avengers 2, of course. Avengers Age of Ultron, I guess it is. And as I wrote in my email to you when I got home, yeah. I'm boom smashed out.
Yeah.
And I liked the first movie. I liked it more the first time I saw it than I did the second time I saw it. But I don't know if I really care that much about that movie. And maybe because this is one of the films that set the template, Star Wars did it too, where realistically the people we care about are not going to die.
Mm-hmm.
Now, we maybe didn't know that back in the 70s and 80s when these films started taking hold. And Spielberg and Lucas were involved in so many of the movies like this. Not always. Sometimes it was just ILM that Lucas ran or Spielberg was a producer, but not really involved in the film directly. But the template that they helped set, basing it on the old serials. When you watch the making of Raiders, the old stuff back in the 80s, or the new documentaries, these two guys have said it probably 700 times. Just like Sidney Lumet saying on Network, it was sheer reportage. I mentioned that he says that over and over and over on the making ofs in the commentary for Network. And Lucas and Spielberg have said the same thing about the old serials, the ongoing cliffhangers. And Raiders is all about that. In fact, they cut two sequences that end up in Temple of Doom. And they're two of the best sequences in Temple of Doom. The opening sequence where Indy has to try to get the diamond and the antidote for the poison he's been fed. And then the minecart chase, which is maybe the best sequence in any of the Indiana Jones films. And that's really saying something. Definitely the most fun part of Temple of Doom, because it's not the most fun movie in the world. Those were both in this movie at one time. Hard to believe that it had been more action than it already does. But I always said The Road Warrior, which was the second movie in that original series, this one that's out right now, Mad Max, is the fourth, because there was a Mad Max, then The Road Warrior, then Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, and now all these years later, this new George Miller film, Fury Road. But the second movie in that series, the first one in the Raiders series, the same year, or within about a year of each other, were the two greatest stunt movies I'd ever seen. And now I think I could put Fury Road on that, although there were some CGI things in there, and Raiders and Road Warrior didn't have that option. But now that I'm 41 years old and I've already said all these things, I'm wondering if I'm also not as involved in these movies as I once was. You never were, it sounds like.
When I was a kid, I liked those kinds of movies a lot more. I was in that demographic, and I was totally into action movies. And I saw Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade when it came out. When was that?
89.
Okay, so I was 11 years old. Yeah. And I remember loving it. And if I were to watch The Last Crusade again this weekend, I probably would have that nostalgia and enjoy it more than Raiders of the Lost Ark because I have those childhood memories and these kind of positive nostalgic associations with it. And I think that's an important part of the appeal of these movies because they have so many child-friendly jokes and aspects mm-hmm. about them. But we're not in that demographic. These people are not making movies for the likes of us. That doesn't mean they're not great movies. Just because they appeal to younger people, I don't think there's anything wrong with it. And, you know, when I likened it to Bon Jovi, part of the reason I use Bon Jovi as an example is because I'm not judging Bon Jovi. I think, obviously, people love those songs and they're really popular. And, hell, I'll tell you, if I'm at a wedding and Living on a Prayer comes on and I'm in my cups, yeah, I'm going to totally dance and sing
along. You will be shot through the heart.
You will be, you'll be alarmed at how many words of the song that I know, but it's just not something I would ever choose to put on.
Okay, so to the story proper, it's set in 1936. Temple of Doom is a prequel, I think it's 1934, but it's a year or two before it anyway. And The Last Crusade's after that, Crystal Skull is quite a ways after that. They shot it all over the globe, just like a Bond film, and that's what this was also based on. Spielberg always wanted to do a Bond film, and Lucas said, I've got something better. We said on Star Wars that when that was coming out, Lucas thought, this is going to bomb, I got to get the hell out of here. And he and Spielberg went to Hawaii, and while they're building sandcastles, as the legend goes.
Like children.
Yeah, well, those two guys, maybe even now, but certainly at that point, were still pretty childish by the sounds of it. Spielberg disclosed he wanted to do a Bond film and probably could have gotten one with the power that he had at that point, although maybe the Bond producers wouldn't want to pay him. But then Lucas said, I got something better. And this is based on the serials. It's based on Bond. It's also based on Nevada Smith, at least the name is, a Steve McQueen movie, Indiana Jones. I think originally it was Indiana Smith as well. Mm-hmm. And then Spielberg wanted to change it to Jones.
Yeah, Spielberg called Indiana Jones James Bond without the hardware.
Doesn't really have any gadgets, does he?
Just the whip,
right? Whip and the gun.
They also admitted to pinching a couple of the sequences, particularly the booby traps in the chamber where the idol is, from old issues of DuckTales. I read DuckTales when I was a kid. Like, we had a bunch of them around the house all the time. And I remember when we were watching the movie thinking, oh, this kind of reminds me of all the old comic books I used to read.
So you're saying Duck. D-U-C-K, yeah, like Tales.
Uncle Scrooge.
Oh, really?
I think it's actually the Uncle Scrooge was the name of the comic. DuckTales was the TV show, sorry. But it would be like Huey, Dewey, and Louie, and Uncle Scrooge would go on adventures. People also claimed Inception was pinched from an issue of Uncle Scrooge comics.
The Christopher Nolan Inception movie.
Yep.
How about that? My favorite quote in the whole movie, and there's a lot of great quotes in this film, it's a very funny script, when Sala says to him, how? About how he's going to get the Ark back? I don't know, I'm making this up as I go. Because I love the way that Ford reads that and the way he plays the whole character, the way he plays that moment. But it's also a crock because this movie's got the big budget and it's not made up on the fly at all. The movie's extremely planned. Or it would have to be, or else people would have got hurt and killed. There are plenty of errors, and people probably know about a lot of these. The fly in the mouth.
Yeah.
Paul Freeman plays Belloc. It's a fly in the mouth. The bouncing boulder when Indian Marion got out of the Well of the Souls, which was not taken out of the Blu-ray cut. Thank God that they didn't try to fix that because it's part of the charm of it. You know what I'm talking about?
I don't know.
When they push open the block to get out of the Well of the Souls and that leads to the flying wing sequence, the boulder bounces twice in the sand. And if it's a big rock boulder, it's not going to bounce at all. And then even the great stunt sequence where Indy is on the truck with the Ark, there's so much clearance under there because that was for the sake of the stunt man, and no one's going to really throw shade on them for that. But still, there's no way there'd be this big trench in the middle of the road.
Yeah, Spielberg made meticulous storyboards. He said that he never worked this hard on storyboards on any other film, but it was because he had so much he wanted to accomplish and they had to keep their schedule or they were going to go over budget. So they storyboarded the hell out of it and kept everything to like 3 or 4 takes.
And they were over in Tunisia, which is where the Tatooine scenes were shot in Star Wars. It was way too hot. People got sick. Everyone probably knows the story about how Harrison Ford had dysentery and didn't want to do a big, long fight sequence with that giant dude with the enormous dagger, knife, blade, where the hell that thing was. So he just pulls out the gun and shoots him. Everyone laughed, said, let's shoot that. But that was part of the reason how they got out of Tunisia quicker. Spielberg got this movie made under budget and under schedule, which is remarkable considering what they were shooting.
That's what planning does.
Not always, though. Most of the movies we've talked about that have been huge hits have gone over schedule. We haven't really talked about schedules that often on the project, I guess. But Apocalypse Now and Jaws certainly did.
Yeah. It's part of the reason probably why Spielberg has such a great reputation is he just didn't let his ego go to his head. And he never became one of those directors that was like, yeah, I went over budget and over schedule on Jaws, but it made all this money, so screw it. I'm just going to do whatever I want from
Even though he was friends with Kubrick and Kubrick was his mentor, he didn't start acting like Kubrick and doing dozens of takes. I remember in the Minority Report making ofs, they talk about how he gets in, he's fast, he works very fast for a guy who's been around this long who could do whatever the hell he wants. He was the producer on most of his films by that point, too. He wasn't quite yet. although he actually is a producer on E.T. the very next year after this. George Lucas was the executive producer on this, and Frank Marshall, a name we're going to talk about in Sixth Sense. Kathleen Kennedy, who was an associate producer for Spielberg, also produces Sixth Sense, so we're going to talk about them right at the end of the project. And both Marshall and Kennedy, who were Spielberg's cronies or friends, he worked with them for a long time. Marshall is still a big player. He's still producing a lot of big movies. Worked with M. Night Shyamalan quite a bit. Kathleen Kennedy runs Lucasfilm now. She's about as powerful in the business as it gets. But Spielberg was responsible then, and apparently still responsible even now, despite the fact he still keeps making massive blockbusters. And sometimes the more intimate films, like A Lincoln, which has a big cast, but is a pretty contained kind of movie, mostly indoors. A movie about people talking, as we've said, many of the movies in the project, and many movies in general are.
Kind of speaks to his range, too, that he makes a movie like Raiders of the Lost Ark, but also a movie like Lincoln or Schindler's List.
Yeah, he didn't start making movies that quote-unquote meant something until, I guess we're talking Color Purple in 85. Right. And then Empire of the Sun, which was the movie he made after that. And then Schindler's List was a few years after that, Saving Private Ryan. He's actually pretty much alternated between making a popcorn movie and making a serious movie. And sometimes they've been both. Schindler's List was a massive hit considering the subject matter. This movie has so many famous things to talk about. But let's get into the Well of the Souls, the scene that doesn't make me quite as queasy or uncomfortable as it used to because I've seen it so many damn times. But it is the snakes. Why do it have to be snakes? There's so many different breeds of snakes in that scene. There's also hoses doubling for snakes and legless lizards because, as the story goes, and if you ever watch the making of on this, it's a pretty funny little moment. They get this massive set, and that's where the Overlook Hotel was shot as well, in The Shining. It burned down, and it delayed shooting on this. And Spielberg said he met Kubrick when he was over there. I guess he was scouting locations or waiting for this set. It's funny how he tells the story as if, well, I get to meet Stanley Kubrick rather than being mad at him for delaying his own filming. And they put these thousands of snakes in one corner of that set, and it looked like there were barely any in there at all. So they had to go and buy all kinds of different ones. That's why there's cobras in there. And it actually was an inhumane situation because some of the snakes attacked other ones
because
they were different breeds. And there's even a story about how the assistant director got a bite and just told somebody, if you grab the tail and kind of wiggle it, I guess, it'll let go. And it did. And he just very calmly said, okay, take me to the hospital now.
Wasn't it a non-poisonous snake that bit him, though?
It may have been.
Yeah, I think so.
But still, I would not want them to be anywhere near me. Everyone knows about the cobra that goes face-to-face with Indy. And they did clean up the shot where Indy lands right in front of it, and you don't see the glass anymore. The videotape, you can see it when the lightning goes off, that there's a glass between them. It's still a great shot. Who cares? And it's also, as an homage to movies made in the 30s and 40s like this, they had way worse problems, continuity, and glaring errors than this anyway.
Clumsy stunts and bad special effects.
Mm-hmm. And who's going to hold it against them for not having a cobra actually be right in Harrison Ford's face? I read a story how it spat venom on the glass as it was.
Yeah.
So it's a good thing they weren't able to just hold it back and say, okay, Harry, it won't actually get you, because I might have spat that venom right at him. When they get out of the Well of the Souls, that leads to a scene that reminds me of another influence from this movie we got to talk about, because we only saw this about a month ago. A documentary called Raiders!
Yeah.
With an exclamation mark. And it's based on three kids that remade Raiders of the Lost Ark in the 80s. Over the course of, I think it was 6 or 7 years, they would try to redo this movie with themselves, acting many different parts. I've never seen that finished product. But what we saw at the Hot Docs Film Festival was the guys grown up now trying to finish the last scene, and that was the flying wing. Spoiler alert on Raiders, the documentary, if you ever do see it, but they finally managed to get that shot. Now, have you seen Raiders, the adaptation?
No, just the same bits that you saw in the documentary.
Mm-hmm. It looks like fun. I'd like to take a look at it one day. Frank Marshall, I mentioned the producer, is actually the pilot in that shot. He gets knocked out by Marion. Marion! Karen Allen, not a big star, seemed like she kind of went away from Hollywood, maybe of her own choosing, I'm not really sure. She should have been a big star for this. She's plucky, she's fun, she's cool. Yeah. She also kills more people than Indy does in this movie, which has a lot of killing in it. We said Apocalypse Now and Deer Hunter, two recent AFI films, were bloody and horrible and a lot of killing in there. Raging Bull is probably harder to watch and tougher, even though there's no killing whatsoever. This movie has way more killing than all those combined, but there's no blood, and if you do it a certain way, then you get a PG rating.
They almost got an R rating, and the censor said that it was because of the head explosion at the end. Mm-hmm. So they just put up that wall of flame that obscures the shot a little bit.
A Belloc.
And then the censors were like, thumbs up, go for it. The body count in this movie is insane. For Raging Bull to get an R rating, and I know that there's language and sexual situations too, but you compare that to people tossing soldiers over cliffs and shooting them dead to rights, just shooting them in the back.
Maybe it's because they're Nazis or they're aggressive Arabs, and who cares about those guys?
You know, Roger Ebert wrote this beautiful
thing about how much he loves Raiders of the Lost Ark, and he insisted that underneath the fun veneer that Spielberg's really trying to express his true disdain for Nazis, but I think they're just shorthand for evil, and they're such cartoonish versions of Nazis.
And isn't it funny that the Arabs are the other modern villain now? You could still use Nazis in them if you wanted to go back and make an old war film, and it'd be shorthand for they're bad guys, murder them, blow their brains out, stab them in the throat. But now the last several years, since 9/11 in particular, anybody who's from the Middle East, shorthand is that they're the bad guys. Mm-hmm. And both of those types of people are the bad guys in our movie here.
It went from Germans to Russians to Arabs, with Hollywood's go-to villain.
And Russians were also in the Indiana Jones series because they are in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. So the flying wing sequence leads to one of the great stunt sequences of all time, and that's on the truck. And Indy never loses his hat. There's a lot of reasons for why he never loses that hat in any of the movies, except for once. He always loses it at some point. The sub, he never has it from that point in the movie on. Marion takes it off to kiss him on the forehead. Then he doesn't have the hat when the Nazis come on board the Bantu Wind, one of the many shirts that the guy in Raiders, the documentary Raiders, is wearing, if you recall.
That's what that was a reference to.
He has two or three different shirts, and all of them are references to things in this movie that you'd never know unless you looked extremely closely. And I looked for the name on the hull in the white shot of the boat, and you do see it. But from that point on, he doesn't have his hat. But why he always has it through all the movies most of the time, one is for continuity. Then you can use a stuntman or a series of stuntmen, and you're not going to realize it's not Harrison Ford. Two is the old adage, a gentleman never loses his hat. And three is the running gag that he just never loses that hat, no matter what happens. In Last Crusade, there's a sequence where he's pretending after many things, including stuffing paper in there, to staple it to his head.
Is it in Temple of Doom where he reaches under the closing door to grab it at the last second?
Also in Raiders in the opening sequence. There's also a connection to modern movies with superheroes. Almost always, towards the end of one of those superhero movies, Spider-Man's a great example of this, the mask is either partially off or all the way off. Captain America often doesn't have his mask on in those movies, although we all know what he looks like, and he's not trying to be anybody else. Kind of a play on the hat thing, maybe.
I have a theory about the mask thing. I think that the reason superheroes are always losing their masks now is because after the first Tobey Maguire Spider-Man movie came out, everybody rightly criticized that the whole last act of the film is just two blank masks without expressions, because you have the Green Goblin and Spider-Man are masked the whole time, and it really takes away from that climax. From then on, they wrote that Peter Parker would lose his mask. The Marvelverse just kind of learned that lesson, and you need to see these actors emote and express themselves.
Fair point. You're paying a lot of money for those faces, so if you're going to cover them up with masks or with hats down over their eyes, that kind of ruins things a little
bit. Even more than that, the performances that you're losing.
Mm-hmm. We just mentioned the opening sequence, so let's talk about that way out of order now. Alfred Molina's very first film, later on to Boogie Nights, Spider-Man 2, and according to Indy, he's Sapito, even though in the credits he's Satipo. You said something about his age, though, didn't you?
He doesn't age, but I don't say that as a compliment to say that, oh, he still looks young. Back then, in 1980, he already looked like he was pushing 50. And what do I think of his character? I don't know, the same thing. They're all archetypes. They're all pretty shallow.
That's also where we meet Belloc, after the famous rolling boulder scene. That's a very fun part of that Raiders documentary, too, how they did their own boulder. But anyway, when the boulder nearly kills Indy, there's Belloc, Paul Freeman, who is later in Hot Fuzz, one of the many famous English actors. Well, maybe not famous, but fairly well-known over there, at least, English actors who end up being bad guys at the end of Hot Fuzz. Oh, spoiler alert for Hot Fuzz, but I think people have seen that movie by now. And it seems that based on that opening sequence where they're in, I think it's supposed to be Peru, and then the rest of the film, where they're over in the Middle East for the most part, in Cairo, Belloc and Indy are the only two archaeologists worth a damn. They're the only ones getting any work.
Yeah.
Although there was Abner Ravenwood, who was Indy's mentor and Marion's father. And what a shame that they didn't get John Hurt to be her father in The Crystal Skull. You didn't see the movie, so I have to explain it now. That there's an older character, John Hurt plays him. He's out of his mind through most of the movie. He's a mentor for Marion and Indy, and even for Shia LaBeouf's character. Okay, fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But why isn't he the father? Then you've got this multi-generational thing going on. Father, daughter, grandson. Beb doesn't know what I'm talking about, so we'll move on from that.
Sure don't.
And Belloc is the French guy who's collaborating with the Nazis just before World War II. He's playing against the Americans as well.
Ebert pointed that out when he was talking about the Nazi connection. Belloc perhaps is standing in for France, playing both sides. Mm-hmm.
My favorite moment in the whole film involves Belloc and Marion, does not involve Indy. And it's the coat hanger.
Oh, yeah. Tote. That is a funny gag.
It looks like it's going to be a torture device that Tote pulls out. And both Marion and Belloc have a look on their face where they're both terrified. why that guy's wearing a coat in the desert anyway is absurd.
What do you mean, why? So that he can have that great coat every day.
I guess that's why, yeah. He also has one of my favorite other moments in the film that doesn't really involve Indy directly. When Indy threatens to blow up the Ark, hello, I'm going to blow up the Ark, Renee. All the Germans scatter, or they point their guns at him, and then Belloc starts yelling at Indy, and they have their big conflict. But if you watch Tote in the background, he just sits down as if to say, okay, you idiots deal with this, and I'm just going to wipe my brow until you're all done with this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Indy has that attitude through a lot of the film, that whole, oh, for God's sake type thing. The Bruce Willis kind of style in a lot of the Die Hard films. The, oh my God, now this too?
Well, because everything's so crazy around him. What do they say, that the blank face is the best action star? Yeah. It has to be...
The Keanu Reeves syndrome.
Yeah, they're the cipher for the audience, so... He has to kind of be the bedrock that all of the wackiness happens around him, so he reacts to it the way the audience does. And he's so great at it, because he's so cool, and he's funny, and he's sardonic, and he's such a great movie star. And I wish all action movies had this. He expresses real peril when he's in a dangerous situation. The look on his face, he's not Mr. Cool, who's just handling it. He's scared. He's scared for his life, as he should be, and it definitely makes the audience way more invested.
Or the moment on the flying wing when the big German dude comes up behind him, and he has that look. I just want to get in this plane and get the hell out of here. But you say about having fear and showing that he's been injured in the scene with him and Marion on the boat where he's, ow, 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 ow. Another thing that plays off the reality of Bruce Willis, at least the first Die Hard, maybe not some of the later sequels, also seems like he's actually hurt, the bloody feet, and he's a normal human being. The Schwarzenegger-Stallone movies in the 80s and the 90s were fun. But one of the worst things about those films is what we now see in the superhero films. These people either can't be hurt, or they don't die, or they maybe come back to life.
Yeah, the invincibility takes away all investment in the action. I mean, you know that Indy's going to be okay, of course, but it's funner when you're feeling that fear with him. Although, as you say, he does take a bullet in his arm and then climb under the belly of that car and do that incredible, it is an incredible stunt. Obviously, he wasn't the one doing it, but we're supposed to believe that Indiana, with a bullet in his shoulder, can pull that off. That's a little hard to believe.
Okay, let's get to the ending where the French weasel gets a bunch of Nazis to participate in a Jewish ritual.
Yeah.
Just because.
You know, it's funny that the Nazis believe enough in the occult and the power of this object to steal it and go to all this trouble to use it. But if they believe in the power of this object, then they also believe that it's a Jewish... object.
They were good for something at one point, then, weren't they?
This is the Jewish God. Why do you think he would take your side? You're Nazis.
Well, they're in the right in their eyes, of course. Although I always knew the Ten Commandments were a crock, and that's why they've turned to dust.
It's strange that they would use something as kind of solemn and serious as the Ten Commandments, Old Testament stuff, to be the MacGuffin in their film, because it does give it a solemnity
that's
the rest
why.
Of the film doesn't have.
I'm sure
I
that's
guess
why.
So, yeah.
And then they use the Holy Grail in the third movie. Same
yes,
thing. One
yeah.
of the more famous object, actually, that most people know. There's the Arthur legend, but also the very famous story of Jesus and the cup.
Mm-hmm.
But let's get back to what you said about how the Nazis want this object that the Jews had originally made many centuries before. Marcus Brody, Denham Elliott, he suggested the Ark is so powerful it levels areas and destroys all kinds of people. But it's funny how it does keep getting captured by bad guys. It's such a powerful thing. One of my least favorite things in the Bible, by the way, and I will get political about this one thing, the unfairness. There's a character, I forget his name now, where the Ark is out in the open, and the Hebrews are walking along, and it's on a donkey cart or something. It starts wobbling as it's going over a rocky road, and he reaches up just to stop it from falling over. He's not trying to get in there. Ooh, I got to see what's in there. I'm going to take the Ark. He's trying to help. Drops dead. Because the rule was, you don't touch the Ark unless you're a priest, and if you do, you will drop dead.
Look, man, the Old Testament God is a well-documented jerk.
That's a great example of why right there. But in that sequence, the Nazis are making a movie of the Ark's grand opening, and that gets ruined by the wrath of God. It's too bad that Belloc performed his ceremony because the Ark might have killed Hitler.
You're right.
If they'd waited to open it when it went back to Germany, all this stuff would have happened in his bunker or his headquarters or wherever they did that big opening rather than on this island.
Damn.
Although Indy and Marion must swim off the island with that Ark, because how did they get out of there?
He's crafty enough to have gotten that far.
He drove the sub, I guess.
Sure, why not? He can do everything else.
That's one of the other things that you call a continuity error or a mistake, at least. How does he manage to make it all the way to that underground sub lair? And people have said he lashed himself to the periscope. Well, even if they rode periscope depth all that way, I've read online that they would have gone so far, he would have died from exposure or lack of water and food, or they would have been spotted by the Nazis at some point when they would look through the periscope or something like that.
I really struggle with the sheer dumbness of the very ending. You can suspend your disbelief so much, but why inside the Ark of the Covenant are these weird...
Poltergeist ghosts?
Poltergeist ghosts.
It's like beautiful!
Ghostbuster ghosts. And they're screaming like banshees. It doesn't jive with the religious thing at all. There's nothing in the Old Testament about banshee ghosts. I mean, I don't know it that well, but it seems pretty unfamiliar to me. But then the craziest part is that the most random thing comes out of the Ark of the Covenant. And yet, Indy still knows that all you have to do is close your eyes and
you're
safe.
Something on the other side of that medallion, because the Nazis, of course, don't have the other side of the medallion. That's why they're digging in the wrong place, because they don't know that you're supposed to have a certain height with that staff. But something on the other side of the medallion that they still have indicates, don't look at it.
Okay, but they never actually say that in the movie. They may have said that in the commentary at some point. When the movie came out, there was no commentary. There was no, like, behind-the-scenes featurettes. The audience would have just been left to decipher that ending with the information they had, which was nothing.
It's not playing fair with us, so I'll give you that much. If he knew that and doesn't say anything about it except to her at that exact moment and doesn't say how he knows that, then yeah, they're not playing fair.
No, and it could be just like the ending of Jaws. Like you said, the ending of Jaws is also pretty dumb. That wouldn't have happened. The shark wouldn't have never behaved like that, but also that oxygen thing wouldn't have blown up when you shot it. But by then you're so invested in the action mm-hmm. that you don't really care and you just forgive the filmmakers anything. And I think probably most people who enjoy this film for what it is are so invested that they don't care that the most dumb thing happens at the very end there, that the climax ends with this random thing.
Well, the reason why Indy doesn't blow up the Ark when he has the bazooka and Belloc dares him to do it is what Belloc says. You want to see what's in there as well as I do. He's also speaking to the audience. We want to know what the filmmakers are saying is actually inside that arc.
Yeah, of course.
And if you're invested in this story, then there's no reason in the world why you wouldn't get invested in that ending and be horrified by it, too. Although, at least it's killing all the Nazis. And ruining their movie, too, which is really not fair.
Wouldn't you just be disappointed that it was such a weird... It almost feels like a cop-out. You know, you take something as grand as the Old Testament, as the Ark of the Covenant, and you have this tacky horror ending.
Because the wrong people meddled with it. I think the movie's implying if a virtuous person had opened it, or a virtuous set of people had opened it,
yeah.
something else would have happened.
Yeah.
Maybe the tablets wouldn't have been destroyed. You're taking it all kinds of magic.
That's why
now.
The screaming banshee ghosts burn the ropes off of Indy and Marion's
yeah.
hands.
So not
yeah.
only do they not
and
get killed.
And burn the Nazi emblem off the box.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not only are they not dead, but they're free. Well, the very end of the film, when the Ark is packed away and put in some gigantic warehouse, is an homage to Citizen Kane, the end of mm-hmm. that film. Spielberg's a huge fan, of course. But by Spielberg standards, it's a very cynical ending. Okay, the Nazis are killed, and that's great, and our hero won. He's got the relic. But even he's annoyed at the very end. Fools, they don't know what they've got there, and they just pack it away. And you see what looks to be thousands of things in crates. What else have they got inside those things?
Yes. The Nazis, of course, we don't want them to get their hands on it. They're going to use it for evil. But why are we supposed to root for Indiana's mission to steal it from the Egyptians and either put it in a museum, an American museum? I'm sure he's not going to give it yeah. to the Egyptians. He's going to use it to benefit his own country, which is robbery. But instead, he trusts the American government, who are immediately totally shady about it.
Well, I said earlier, Brody. And by the way, Marcus Brody. I wonder if that's a deliberate play on Martin Brody from Jaws. Now, Martin Brody is a name in the book Jaws. Marcus Brody is a completely made-up thing because this is a completely made-up movie, no book to be based on.
They do like to name their characters with homages. Pauline Kael, that we talk about a lot, notorious film critic, hated Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm-hmm. And years later, after she blazed it, Lucas named a villain in Willow after her, General Kael, something yeah. Kael.
That's like Saris, the bad guy in Galaxy Quest, and that's because the director got burned by Andrew Saris, the film yeah. critic, on some previous film. It is funny, though. The movie begins without that very famous dun da da dun da da. It's very low, melodic kind of music. And then it ends on this dark note, although that music does play over the warehouse credit sequence. But you don't have that rousing opening. It takes a little while to get to that rousing opening with the boulder and everything. That does happen, but it's about 5 minutes in. And the very end is the American government can't be trusted either. At least they're keeping this thing away from the actual bad guys. But I mentioned Marcus a minute ago. Let me finish that point. When he goes over to Indy's house to say that the government is going to pay to send him over there to go on this mission in the first place, Indy says something like, and it'll go to the museum, right? Yes, of course. And the way Marcus says that, he knows right then and there. No, it's not. I'm not implying that he's doing anything wrong. He's probably been told by the government, this is what's going to happen and you're going to have to go along with it. The look on his face tells us right off the bat that if Indy wins, no museum's getting that arc. Before we get to the cast and crew, is Indy just a bystander who doesn't impact the plot in this movie?
Oh my gosh, good question.
It's been floated out there that yes, he finds the Ark, and he's the reason why they know where it is, but then they take it away from him. And then he doesn't really do anything from the point of the sub-sequence to the end of the film, except tell Marion not to open her eyes.
He really is just a cipher for the audience.
The last sequence, for sure, the Nazis beat themselves.
Yeah.
The rest of the movie, it's debatable to say he doesn't impact the plot, but the climax, he doesn't.
Well, he impacts the plot in how it pertains to him and Marion, but other than identifying the actual location of the Ark, does he do anything that would otherwise alter what happens?
Well, he and Sala get the Ark up out of that Well of the Souls through all the snakes, too.
Sure, but the Nazis would have done that had they just found the spot where it was buried.
During that sequence, we love to point out that it's dusk and everybody's digging, which they wouldn't be. They'd be going home for the night. And Indy takes off his costume and he reveals his hat. No wonder Belloc and everybody see him up there. What are those guys doing? Never mind, don't look that way. Belloc doesn't do much of anything in either one of those sequences. He just takes stuff that Indy finds.
Indiana robs a grave, and Belloc robs Indiana.
And Belloc wins the first time, but not the second time. Murdered by flames. All right, the cast. Harrison Ford is fourth of five AFI films. We've seen him so much in the 70s and now into the 80s. He's still got Blade Runner in a few weeks for us. Previous ones were American Graffiti, Star Wars, and then briefly in Apocalypse Now. And he's also in a deleted scene as the principal in E.T., he could have been in six AFI films and another blockbuster hit. Another example of a character who could have been played by so many big actors. Tom Selleck would have had the role.
Yeah.
But Magnum P.I. wouldn't let him out of it. And actually, with their shooting schedule, he could have done Raiders by the time they actually started shooting in Hawaii when the series got going after its pilot. Steve Martin, Bill Murray, Tim Matheson, who also almost had the role, Chevy Chase, Jack Nicholson, some of the big names that were mentioned. The reason why Lucas didn't want to use Ford is because he'd been in Star Wars. He didn't want to use somebody from his previous film. But then they just realized he's the best choice for it. And I think Spielberg kind of pushed it that way and said, I like him. He's going to be good in this role.
I thought of something just like that when Chris Pratt, who is being talked about being cast as the new Indiana Jones, but he's also getting every big franchise movie role right now. And people are going to get Chris Pratt fatigue.
Zoe Saldana, too. She's been in Star Trek. She's been in Avatar. And she's in Guardians of the Galaxy with Pratt. So she's got three franchises at once. It's impressive enough to have two.
But they're that good. Chris Pratt made Guardians of the Galaxy absolutely amazing, and I do want to see him in more movies. Oh, in Jurassic Park. That's the other
one. That's right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And you would want to cast him because he's great, and everybody loves him. But you wouldn't want to cast him because you don't want to be that movie that put out over the edge for everybody.
And that may be what Lucas thought with this one, but they'd made the right choice because everyone has always loved Ford in this role. And it's one of the most iconic costumes of all time. They put the hat and the whip and the jacket into the Smithsonian, but then took him back out when they made the last movie that Carl doesn't want us to mention anymore. All right, his co-star Karen Allen, she's tomboy, she's a gutsy damsel, although she does need his help an awful lot.
Oh, yeah.
Andy!
During that part of the film, I yelled out, Barry! It sounds exactly the same, the tone, the intonation.
From Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Mm. She was back in the fourth movie as the love interest all over again, but really hasn't been a big player ever since the mid-80s, I guess, with Starman, and then Animal House was also before Raiders.
To me, she is always from Scrooged.
Oh, and there's that, too. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm not a big Scrooge fan, so I didn't think to mention that one. The drinking game she has early on in her bar that gets burned down establishes her as tough, but it also pays off later because she's trying to get Belloc drunk so she can escape, although why she would try to do that when he even says it's 3 days in every direction to get out of this desert. She would certainly not make it out of there. But at least there's a reason for that. We're showing that she's got the ability to hang with the guys, and she's cool and all that. But they also have a reason to put that scene in when it does pay off.
Yeah, I really like that detail. She's also an even more remarkable drinker than you think, because in both cases, after all that booze, she seems to sober up. Toot sweet.
She seems to be sober, not sober up. She's not drunk at all. All right, John Rhys-Davies, Sala. He will be in Lord of the Rings, Fellowship of the Ring. And of course, he was in all three of those films. He's in Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade, but he's more comic relief than he even is in this film, actually. That could have been Danny DeVito. Mm-hmm. I think they made the right choice in going with the guy who actually looks like he's from over that part of the world. I think he might be an English actor. And he's one of the only people from the Indiana Jones series who's in that Raiders documentary they made about the kids, now grown men.
And he has the best story I've ever heard about
also
this
movie.
Also,
about dysentery problems that Ford had.
Where he was so sick that at one point on set, he was crouching down or something, and he just went in his pants. And I didn't care.
Yeah, they were so tired and hot and had enough of that place. Ronald Lacey is Tote, his only AFI film. Not an actor you've probably heard of before or very much since. He got his first job on TV in 1959. And you know who could have had this role instead? Klaus Kinski.
Yeah, but he hated the script.
He said, nine!
He said that it was moronically stupid. Something really mean.
He wanted to work with Spielberg, but not on this particular project. And I guess Spielberg never decided to cast him in a later film. Those great eyes. If you've never seen a Werner Herzog film with Klaus Kinski, you really should. We mentioned, I think, on Apocalypse Now, actually, Aguirre, the Wrath of God.
Is that's
where
he
got it started. Yeah, he's Aguirre.
Oh my God, what a loss not casting him. He's amazing.
Although I thought Ronald Lacey was great, too.
Yeah, he was.
Oh, sit here, do you stupid people figure this stuff out. All right, Denham Elliott, who plays Marcus Brody, was also in Trading Places a few years after this film, and he was in The Last Crusade. Much like Salah, much more comic performance than the first film, where he seems, for the most part, competent. His career began in 1949, so he had a long time in the business. And that's all the cast I really need to talk about. So let's move on to the director. Steven Spielberg is third of six AFI films. We still have E.T. next week, in fact. Schindler's List and Saving Private Ryan. So we're getting more and more serious as we go along after the fun of Jaws and Close Encounters. Well, Close Encounters maybe not as much fun as it could have been, but Jaws and Raiders certainly are. But forget those films for a minute, because he was coming off of 1941, one of his infamous failures, which he never talks about now. It's one thing about Spielberg I don't like that much. He seems to distance himself from failures. And you
Doesn't
made the movie.
Everybody who still talks about movies that bombed?
Kevin Costner does.
Yeah?
When he was on Inside the Actors Studio, they talked about a lot of movies that he knows people don't like that much. And he was excited talking about all of his movies. Wow. I always remember about his appearance on that show that he stood up. A lot. He would stand up and talk almost like he was doing a seminar for these people,
really?
Rather than just casually sitting back with his water talking to James Lipton. He was really into it, and I kind of admired that about him. As much as Costner's taking heat, and of course he's nothing close to the filmmaker that Spielberg is, but at least he doesn't try to pretend like, no, I didn't do that failure. No, no, you didn't see nothing. Well, we did see something.
He owns it. He still even likes his movies.
I think he gets excited about the whole process, and he's made more duds than Spielberg probably ever will at this point, but you have to admire that about him at least. The writers, Lawrence Kasdan, who was later known for The Big Chill only a few years after this, probably still his best film, although Silverado was a pretty fun movie, with Kevin Costner as one of the guys in that Western. And then Lucas and Philip Kaufman got story credit. Philip Kaufman directed, I think it was The Right Stuff, only a couple years after this. Yeah. All these guys involved in this movie. I mentioned some of the producers, or the associates at least, Kathleen Kennedy and Frank Marshall, got huge jobs in the years that followed. Kasdan is involved with the screenplay of the new Star Wars film, too. Lucas was an executive producer. Frank Marshall was the main producer. So Marshall would have been the guy to go up there if they'd won Best Picture, even though everyone always thinks about these movies as Spielberg, Lucas, and Ford. Okay, behind the camera now, the 2.35:1 print. Very attractive looking Blu-ray. They did a great job on restoring that, although I think the DVD was pretty good as I recall, and even the videotape was not too bad. The cinematographer shooting it, Douglas Slocum. He shot all three of the original Indiana Jones films, but retired after The Last Crusade, and then he wasn't even alive when they did the new one, so Janusz Kaminski, Spielberg's longtime cinematographer since Schindler's List, shot that one, and tried to make it look a lot like the movies that Slocum made. Very comic booky as well. You're not getting red, white, and blue comic book kind of look in this film, because there's a lot of sand and the kind of washed out sort of look that that can give, but the colors do pop, especially for a film around that time. Michael Kahn was the editor. He did every Spielberg AFI film except for Jaws. That belonged to Verna Fields. And as we know, he's edited just about every Spielberg movie ever anyway, AFI or not. John Williams again does the music. His seven AFI films continues. He's got how many more? E.T., Schindler's List, Saving Private Ryan. I guess that's it because he's done Jaws, Star Wars, Close Encounters, and now this. The two main themes that he came up with were... And then... So he wrote those two and played them for Spielberg, who liked them both, and he incorporated both of them into the main theme.
You just love this soundtrack, and I agree. That great main theme, phenomenal. It's a really good song.
There's a John Williams CD I have. It's two discs, actually, of all of his great compilations. And of course, it's fun to hear Star Wars. Jaws, actually, as much as I love the soundtrack in that, is better within the movie. It's not really great to just sit down and listen to. But the themes I like the most on that whole thing, blast me not to say Star Wars... But it would be this and Superman, and actually JFK is a great theme, too. And he's got 8 or 10 great ones.
Yeah.
So everyone loves Star Wars, and I do, too. And E.T. is a great theme. We're going to hear that one next week.
I don't love big, bombastic soundtracks, but when a movie is this silly and adventure-based, really works. This is the type of movie where you can put it all out there.
It needs
which
to
he
be
does.
Huge.
Yeah,
and it needs great. That huge orchestra. When I say my favorite, I'm talking about the most enjoyable, just to listen to. Not
yeah,
so much
outside
the best
movie.
Score, the most appropriate score. Because I still say Jaws is that, although Star Wars is the most famous of all of them.
It's just a good song, period.
Mm-hmm. Norman Reynolds did the sets. He was involved in the Star Wars trilogy, also Superman and Mission Impossible. And these sets were pretty damn impressive. They had to come up with these foreign locations. I guess a lot of them were on foreign locations, although certainly did a lot of them in the studio too. But they made it look like they were back in the 30s in the middle of nowhere over mm-hmm. in Egypt. The Well of the Souls is obviously the red letter set, although that opening sequence
yeah,
too,
yeah,
down absolutely. Where the idol is. And then Richard Edlund, who has 6 Oscars on his mantle. A lot of them are uncontested special achievement type awards. But he was one of the guys involved in visual effects in this. And even if you didn't like those ghosts, for 1981, before they had
sure.
CGI, that's pretty damn impressive.
Sure, yeah.
And he was also involved in Ghostbusters, which of course had ghosts too. Okay, we covered a lot of the influence. The sequels, of course, and the prequel, because Temple of Doom is actually a prequel. And then the young Indiana Jones TV series that Lucas did in the 90s. Goonies, that Spielberg produced for Richard Donner, is just Indiana Jones for kids.
Yeah.
Complete with all the booby traps. I said booty traps. Count the ripoffs. There's probably hundreds, but some of the bigger ones are Romancing the Stone with Danny DeVito,
yeah.
who could have been in this film, and then Tomb Raider with Angelina Jolie.
And even to a lesser degree, movies like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Yeah.
It was very influential on action movies. Mm-hmm. That relentless pace is something that was repeated even, like we said, in the Marvel films.
And maybe as influential as Star Wars in that way, because Star Wars is set in a fictional universe and out in space, and not everybody can have the budget to do that. But anybody could set a movie wherever they want in the world and have this basic idea going on of we're going to find this relic against the bad guys and it's the countdown to who gets there first and who's going to win. And anybody can make that movie, even on a medium-sized budget or even a small budget. But Star Wars would be tough to do, even as a ripoff, on anything other than a pretty good-sized budget. I keep mentioning that Raiders documentary about those 12-year-old kids back in the early 80s. Here are their names. Eric Zala, I guess that's how you say his name, Z-A-L-A, and Chris Strompolis.
If you're a fan of Raiders of the Lost Ark, you will definitely love this documentary. And probably the remake that they made, too.
Mm-hmm. The awards and AFI lists. The movie won 4 Oscars for Khan's editing, the visual effects by Edlund and friends, the sets by Reynolds and friends, and the sound design. The 4 failed nominations were all pretty big ones. Best Picture, Best Director, the cinematography by Slocum, and Williams' music. The losses in those categories were To Chariots of Fire, Warren Beatty won Best Director over Spielberg for Reds, and then Reg won for cinematography as well. The music, I believe, was also Chariots of Fire.
Yeah, it was.
And then on Golden Pond won 3 of its own, including 2 acting awards. I guess those 4 movies split almost every award you could ask for in 1981. And the film won a special achievement Oscar for Ben Burtt and his buddy Anderson. I didn't write down his first name, I forget. Sorry, Mr. Anderson's sound effects. Ben Burtt won an award for Star Wars, so he has more than his share of Oscars at home too, just like Edlund does in the special achievement category. The movie made the National Film Registry in 1999, and it's only got 2 other AFI recognitions, but they're both pretty impressive. It was 10th on the Top 100 Thrills. I thought maybe it'd be even higher than that, but there's nothing wrong with being in the top 10. And Dr. Jones was the 2nd greatest heroic fellow on the Heroes and Villains list. Number 1 was Atticus Finch from To Kill a Mockingbird, and our dog Sam was originally named Atticus. Useless trivia for you right there. The failed nominations on the AFI lists, only 2 other ones, and the top runner quotes, "Why'd it have to be snakes?" And the other one was in the top 25 music scores. Could have been a lot of other quotes, but okay, at least it had that one nomination. Okay, so we're 2 films in the 80s now, and what a difference we've had. Raging Bull, now Raiders of the Lost Ark. Next week is E.T., and Blade Runner's after that. And by the way, we'll be taking a week off at the end of the month. It isn't really Canada Day just yet on the Monday. I think Canada Day is on a Wednesday this year. But we're going to take a week off to recharge, get caught up a little bit on this stuff, and just enjoy ourselves. Then we'll get back into the middle of 1982, the biggest year of the 80s by far. But here we are, the big action film, the favorite of so many people that we know. What are your final thoughts, including what you thought of it being 66th, the second list, and 60th, the first list, so it's going down?
I was surprised it wasn't higher, mm-hmm. period, because I know so many people who love this movie with all their heart. Obviously, it's a giant of the genre, and it just happens to be a genre that doesn't turn my crank. And I don't disparage that people love it, but now that I don't have a reason to watch it again, I'll never reach for it.
Oh, if I watch it late at night by myself, then
yes,
like they watched
well.
The Last Crusade last night. These movies will always seem fun, probably when I'm 65 years old. If I were ranking it, I don't know where I'd put it in my own list. It would definitely be way higher than the 60s. Probably the top 25, anyway. I'm definitely a Spielberg fan. And this is his wheelhouse. The guy was a fun filmmaker. We said he made a lot of serious movies as he got older. And even when he was not that old, with Color Purple in 85. And those are good films. Color Purple, Schindler's List, Empire of the Sun is okay. Saving Private Ryan's a great war film. Lincoln's a solid film, you didn't like it that much. But when he's long dead, he's going to be best remembered for the fun action films. And I've said many times, the movie that will be on his tombstone, for what he is as a filmmaker, I'm not saying it's his best film, But what represents him best is the one we're doing next week, and it is E.T., another minor Spielberg success. So, the coming attractions trivia for E.T. How many of the 9 AFI films released in the 80s, only 9 in those 10 years, are on Box Office Mojo's top 200 adjusted for inflation?
Oh, that's interesting. All right, so for the answer to that question, please tune into next week's podcast. If you'd like more trivia from Ryan and me, along with all kinds of other fun stuff, including links to some of the things that we talked about in today's podcast, please visit our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. If you would like to message Ryan and I directly, please send us an email, top100projectpodcast@gmail.com. And what's more, we would like to warmly thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Asps, very dangerous. You go first.
And cut.